Today is a very special day for me, as I'm hugely honoured to welcome onto the show the most versatile musician, the most amazing talent, not only of our time, but of any time, a true music legend, the one and only Lalo Schifrin. Thank you so much for sparing some of your valuable time to speak with me on the show.
It's a great pleasure. Believe me.
Now, I can think of no other man who is able to excel not only at being a composer, an arranger, a pianist, as well as a conductor. But that's what makes you such an incredible talent, and it's a genuine pleasure to have you on the show. Now, with more than over 100 film scores, as well as numerous jazz and symphonic works to your credit, you seem to be so creative in all areas. There's very little you haven't been able to channel your talents into. But before we move forward to your more recent works, if we could just step back in time to the beginnings. Now, I believe your father was a symphonic violinist. So did that passion...
Yes, he was the concertmaster of the Buenos Aires Philharmonic.
Did that passion rub off on you at an early age?
Yes, he was for 35 years the concertmaster of the orchestra, and also introduced me to some of his friends, like the father of Daniel Barenboim, Enrique Barenboim, who was my first piano teacher and was a friend of his.
Now, despite having studied sociology, you must have, which must have given you an insight into human life, you also studied law. However, I understand it was music that really fired you up. When did you decide to change direction and go into that full time?
Scholarship.
You got a scholarship, yes.
I studied in the Paris Conservatory when I was a teenager, and I got a scholarship from the Paris Conservatory, and I studied there. I studied with Olivier Messiaen and some of the great French composers of the 20th century.
Yes, indeed. I mean, many people would consider Argentina to be a melting pot of musical flavours. So why, at the age of 20, did you apply and successfully win the scholarship to the Paris Conservatoire?
Well, I was studying Buenos Aires with Juan Carlos Paz. Juan Carlos Paz, who was a disciple of Schoenberg. He was one of the avant-garde composers in Argentina. And he told me that there was an opening in the French embassy to give and they would go directly to the Paris Conservatory. And I said to him, do you think I have a chance? And he said, you have nothing to lose.
This is true. I understand as a teenager you embraced American jazz and you couldn't understand why people treated jazz differently. I also believe you represented your country at the International Jazz Festival in Paris while studying classical music at the Paris Conservatoire. Was this something that you wanted to combine together to have a classical background but also to move into jazz?
Well, I couldn't see the difference between the quality of classical music and jazz. They both had their own discipline, their own harmonic and counterpoint. There was a difference in the sense of improvisation, but let's not forget that in classical music there was improvisation too. For instance, the cadenzas of the Mozart concertos, they were all improvised. So
you must have been inspired playing piano to the man who created Libertango, Astor Piazzolla. What was that experience like for you?
Well, I met Piazzolla much later. I was not captivized by the tango at the beginning. As a matter of fact, jazz is so different from tango that I didn't care, and I didn't meet Piazzolla at the beginning. I met him in Paris, actually, and also I became friends with him when I went back to Buenos Aires, and he asked me to conduct his concerto for bandoneon and orchestra, and we became friends.
We were talking of the 50s earlier. I believe it's when you were playing in your own big band concert in the mid-1950s that it led you to meeting Dizzy Gillespie, who I understand asked you to become his pianist and arranger.
Yeah, that was very important. That was probably the most important career change in my life. Actually, I was expecting that because I gear all my studies and all my focus into the Gillespie style. And I liked so much that he came to Argentina with his big band. He called it United, the USA Big Band, sent by the State Department, American State Department. And I became so... Well, actually, I already knew his style, and I was crazy about it. I went to all his concerts, and I met him, and he asked me... as a matter of fact, I played for him. I had a big band myself. I played for him, and at the end of my performance, he said, "Who wrote all this?" And I said, "I did." And he looked at me and said, "Would you like to come to the United States?" And I couldn't believe it. So that was the beginning of my... That's why I came to the United States. And that's why I'm here.
You found a kindred spirit there. Now, you also subsequently worked with the likes of Count Basie, Ella Fitzgerald, Grady Tate and Sarah Vaughan. How would you personally describe these experiences, and how did it feel making these collaborations?
Well, you can imagine it was fantastic. As a matter of fact, I wrote a piece for a suite called Gillespie and I. It's a musical portrait of Dizzy, and he got a lot of success. As a matter of fact, that led me to come to Hollywood, because people who heard it, they sent me to Hollywood.
Yes.
Hello?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And you worked with Jimmy Smith on The Cat and The Cat Strikes Again. Am I right in thinking that Jimmy also helped, in a sense, to move you to Verve and MGM?
All these things that were happening... They were all results of my collaboration with Dizzy. My name became very known here in the United States because of my collaboration with Dizzy. And therefore, many artists like Jimmy Smith, as a matter of fact, his manager, named Clarence Avant, became my manager, and he's the one who got me the contract to come to Hollywood to do my first movies for MGM.
And it was when you were under contract to MGM, you were offered your first Hollywood film assignment for the African adventure Rhino. How did you approach that first undertaking in the world of film music? Did you find it daunting to move into that sort of, into a different field of film music, or was it very natural?
No, I think at that time there was a need for film composers, and as a matter of fact, the studios and producers, they were looking for a new sounds. They didn't get the great scores by the first composers like Max Steiner, you know, the European Franz Waxman. They were symphonic composers, are very good. They knew what they were doing. But the producers and the studios, they were looking for something a little bit jazzier, and that's why I came in.
Absolutely. Now, as I mentioned earlier, you have more than 100 film scores to your credit. Did you go to watch many movies when you were young, and what did you pick up from that experience?
Well, first of all, let me tell you that my father took me a lot to the Teatro Colón. That's where the Philharmonic of Buenos Aires was. They were working, and they had an opera season. So he took me to see operas. And the basis of film music is, I tell always young composers who want to get into the field of film music, I study opera, because that's the place where music and drama or comedy is a counterpoint. And if you can handle that, you'll be able to handle film. And I was very fortunate that my father took me to see many operas, and I learned a lot about at least I got the feeling how to write music for drama or for tragedy or for comedy. So that's the way it happened.
That's very interesting. Now, I believe not only did Stanley Wilson's Universal music chief act as a mentor, but Bernard Herrmann, a fellow composer, had his own take on what a composer was. What knowledge did he pass on to you?
Well, Stanley Wilson was a great, great human being, a great mentor. He's the one who brought many composers to Universal. Some of my colleagues, like the great John Williams and Jerry Goldsmith, as I said, it was a new concept of composers, and he is the one who discovered them. And not only he gave us a lot of enthusiasm and advice, Stanley Wilson was a great guy.
It's wonderful when you find a mentor like that, isn't it? Now, I mean, different mediums surely require a different approach. How did your approach differ when creating the now iconic TV theme for Mission Impossible and Mannix, both utterly brilliant, in comparison to writing a film score?
Well, first of all, I have to thank you. I'm overwhelmed by your criticism. Huh. But I tell you, the way I came with it was a producer, Bruce Geller, who created both television series, Mission Impossible and Mannix, and I wrote the themes for both of them. And he was also very enthusiastic and very communicative, and he knew how to give me the initial inspiration to write those themes.
That's interesting, because I was going to say, where does your inspiration come from, and how do you start off the process of composing?
Oh, the inspiration came from the screen.
Mm.
From, you know, the inspiration in film music comes from the screen. It's impossible to write a fugue, for instance, an abstract fugue for a movie theme. It has to come from what the characters, from the story, the script, the acting. So that all this comes from that.
Yes. I mean, some composers are instantly recognisable from their, say, predominant use of strings or violins, but your score from, say, Plastic Jesus from Cool Hand Luke to Enter the Dragon couldn't be more different, which is the joy of film composing, I guess. It's been said of your work that your music has a synthesis of traditional and 20th century techniques, and your love of jazz and rhythm are strong attributes of your style. How would you personally describe your style?
I can't. I cannot be my own critic.
Mm-hmm.
I have to leave this to people like you.
Now, of course, working in the industry and being respected the world over is an enormous award in itself, though you have received numerous prestigious awards. Did you agree with those scores being awarded, or would you like to have seen other scores awarded instead?
I cannot complain about anything. I'm very happy the way things are.
You very rightly won 2 Grammy Awards for Mission Impossible, which is such an enduringly brilliant theme. And it has been, like your other scores, used in various different scenarios. For example, it was used here in the UK for a Carling Black Label advert, and was also used by NASA. How do you feel when you hear your music being used in another context?
Well, I've been very satisfied.
That somebody else has seen the brilliance,
yeah.
Really. Yeah, it's wonderful. Now, regular listeners of the show will have heard me play many of your scores numerous times, such as my love for your music. And I could sit here and name all the scores and music that I love, but we would be here for at least a month. So I have to say, though, that I do adore the Dirty Harry theme. It's got so many polyrhythms, not just jazz, but funk and rock. It's a fantastic fusion of many styles. What was your aim for this main theme? And how did director Don Siegel approach this theme, and indeed the entire score, with you?
I don't have any aim. I just have the aim My aim only is to write the right score for the right movie or the right television show.
Was there a particular approach that Don Siegel and yourself had towards the score?
Oh, Don Siegel was great. I mean, I had a great time working with him. He was almost like a musician.
That must have been very helpful.
Yeah, oh yes. And he said that he didn't know any music, but he did. And he knew how to communicate.
That's so crucial, isn't it? I mean, how did you discover the sound? And did you ever feel in your heart, we talked about pride a moment ago, but did you ever feel in your heart that this could go on to become an iconic and truly cool score that it has been?
Always curious about the nature of sound. And I investigated, I was very lucky to have the opportunity to approach musicians who had a great repertoire of sounds, and I put them together.
Now, I have to say at this point, thank you so much for all the music that you've brought to me, and I must agree with director Brett Ratner of Rush Hour when he described you as one of the greatest composers that ever lived, and that there's nobody hipper than Lalo Schifrin. You were such a driving force in creating and defining the sound of the 1970s film score. Did you feel at the time, in any sense, that you were creating a new sound in film scores?
Oh, they are coming always with new sound. There are new composers that are coming with new sound. They are using also, I've been using also electronic, or combination of electronic and acoustic. I mean, the problem is not the sound. The problem is if we have something to say, we have something to say. And that doesn't matter how we say. It's like in literature, you know, the great writers, they had something to say, and it doesn't matter how they said it. They combine words, they combine phrases. It's a matter of syntaxis and grammar and what they have to say.
It's a form of communication and expression.
Yes.
Now, it must be so hard to choose, as you've worked with so many diverse directors, but if you did have to cite one or two, who would you say were the most satisfying to work with?
Oh, I was satisfied to work with all of them.
Anyone stand out in particular?
Well, you said Don Siegel, and he's one of them. My son, and this is not nepotism, I have my son, Ryan Schifrin, who did a movie and wrote a movie called Abominable. It's a horror movie. And he uses the same approach that Don Siegel does. And I communicate with him and I wrote the music. It's one of my latest scores.
It seems that some directors just like to work with certain composers time and time again. Danny Elfman and Tim Burton, John Williams and Steven Spielberg. And could it be said that your score for Coogan's Bluff in 1968 heralded a beginning of a long association with Clint Eastwood and director Don Siegel?
Don Siegel, and also Stuart Rosenberg, with whom I wrote Cool Hand Luke and many other movies.
What do you think it was about that long association with Clint Eastwood, Don Siegel, that really made you all gel, do you think?
It was a fantastic association. Daddy Harry, but before Daddy Harry, or after Daddy Harry, I did many things with him.
Yes. Now, though few can deny the brilliance of action film scores ranging from Bullet to Dirty Harry to Mission Impossible, you've created some beautiful, lilting, soft soundtracks like The Fox, which has so many gorgeous tracks on it and was Academy Award nominated. How does the preparation for you change on each score, and do you have a routine way of working?
Well, it's very satisfying, and they gave me the opportunity to say something, and I said it. The whole thing is much simpler than you think. I appreciate your curiosity, and I appreciate your enthusiasm about all these things. The whole thing is much simpler.
Now, of course, some directors are not so great to work with and lack any real understanding of what they want from a composer. And I believe, like one of your heroes, Sir William Walton, who was taken off the score for the Battle of Britain and replaced by Ron Davis, you had a similar experience with William Friedkin on The Exorcist.
Yeah, that was a misunderstanding. The problem with that movie was that when they did the screening, the first screening of the movie with my music, people were leaving the theater because they were very scared. They were very afraid. And it was too much. And I learned a very good, very, very, very valuable lesson, was not to make it so terrifying.
It's such a brilliant sound creation, but being deemed too scary can sometimes work against you, I suppose. Now, of course, I'm talking as we were the Battle of Britain there. Your score for The Return from the River Kwai is once again highly original, and I really love that. Now, of course, film music and suspense to me seems not just about the music, but sound. And with Amityville and Scorpio's View in Dirty Harry, both have some very eerie sounds, and I notice you're not afraid to leave space, which I find quite chilling. What's your take on that?
Everything you said, the above, all the above. Well, the suspense comes, as I said, from the screen, and I created my own techniques of suspense. But, you know, that's, I wrote two books in my, I mean, not music, but books, English books, books in English. One is called Mission Impossible, the Lalo Schifrin Memoirs, something like that. It's a book of anecdotes and my history. And the other is a book of technique, the composition techniques for movies and television. And in that I analyze the secret of how to write music for suspense. In this interview, it's a very technical book, but I would advise many people to read it, you know, because it tells you the secret, the very secret that you are asking me, what is the secret of suspense, is in that book.
Our previous guest on the show, Sir Richard Rodney Bennett, who composed The Billion Dollar Brain, he mentioned that he didn't feel he could give advice to newcomers because he felt film music had changed so much. Is that your view, or do you have any advice for aspiring film composers?
Film music, like any other music, is changing because it's a human... It's the product of human action. So everything in humanity changes. And yes, it changed.
What would you...
And it's good.
Yes.
It's very healthy. Very healthy that it's changing.
What advice would you give to aspiring film composers?
Study opera. The thing is to listen to the scores and not analyze too much. Enjoy the scores and think about the only thing that everybody should, the beginners, or composers, or even the public, especially the public, the only thing is, does this score work? And does it help the movie? Does it make a contribution to the movie's story?
Yes.
And that's what it counts.
Now, for someone so versatile and multi-talented, it must have been a real joy to release your album into sections, Jazz Meets the Symphony, as it allows you the freedom to express both your loves. Now, you've had Brazilian jazz, Latin jazz, which is fantastic music, but then you're also involved in a lot of classical work, not least with the conductor Zubin Mehta, who was at the helm of the magnificent Three Tenors concert that you arranged for. Can you tell us about the jazz work, as well as working with Zubin Mehta on the Three Tenors?
Oh, that was nice. That was very, very, very nice. As I said, my beginning with opera gave me the opportunity to know how to write for three tenors. I can write for sopranos, or basses, or baritones. That's a whole technique of how our orchestra can work for for solo vocalist, and that is, again, we go back to the opera.
Now, the Three Tenors concert was such a truly magical experience. It's no surprise to hear the record and videotape of the event has gone to become the biggest seller in the history of classical music.
Let me tell you something. It was so successful that I found my own three tenors. I found three tenors from Mexico and Latin America, young tenors who were very, very good, and they learned the repertoire, and I went on tour. As a matter of fact, I conducted in England, in Vienna. I conducted the same medleys. I conducted them with other tenors, and it was a great experience too.
To celebrate your 80th year, Elf Records released a 4-CD box set called Lalo Schifrin, My Life in Music, spanning 50 years of accomplishment. It sounds of your film music, and it includes 36 of your film tracks and some previously unreleased music. What else does it include, and was it a joy to go back into the studio to record these pieces?
I'd like to give you examples to answer your questions. For instance, I wrote a suite called Latin Jazz Suite, which is using all the things that you're talking about, or some of the things you're talking about. Another one I did is called Esperanto. It's called Esperanto because Esperanto was an experiment that somebody did about writing a language that would encompass all the languages in the world, Esperanto. Actually, that experiment didn't work out. Why? Because there was already an universal language, which was music. So I wrote Esperanto, and that's a record. I would advise you and everybody who wants to get the record of Esperanto, and you see what I'm talking about.
Now, you've been honoured with a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. You've received 4 Grammy Awards and 6 Oscar nominations. At Lumiere 2012 Grand Lyon Film Festival, they honoured you with a Lifetime Achievement Award. You've also received the Max Steiner Film Music Achievement Award from the City of Vienna, and the J. McShane Lifetime Achievement Award by the Oklahoma Jazz Hall of Fame in Tulsa, and they recognised your contribution to jazz throughout 6-decade career. You really are one of the greatest composers in film history. Now, the title of your book, My Life in Music, is such a great title, and it begs the question, if you had to sum up your life in music, how would you describe it, and what else is left to achieve for Lalo Schifrin?
I have to thank you. First of all, I have to thank you. You are such a You're very good for my ego, because you believe so much in me, and I really appreciate that. I am a musician. I'm not very good for words, but as a musician, I tell you, the words that I use in 2 books, the autobiography and the music analysis. The 2 books, they describe everything I have to say about myself or about everything I've done.
Now, I have to say, talking to you on my show has been a dream come true for me, as your music has not only enriched my life, but those of many millions around the world. You truly deserve all the honours that have been bestowed on you. You're very much the greatest of them all. Thank you so much, and God bless you, Lalo Schifrin.
Thank you very much, and very good luck to you.
Thank you. And that was the truly incredible Mr. Lalo Schifrin.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time. Thanks very much. Bye-bye. Brooklyn's Radio.